The thing is, I get that this could be a good life. I get that with you around, perhaps it could even be a very good life. But it's not my life. I'm not the same as these people you speak to. It's nothing like the life I want. Not even close. His voice was halting, broken. His expression frightened me. I swallowed, shaking my head. You once told me that the night in the maze didn't have to be the thing that defined me. You said I could choose what it was that defined me. Well, you don't have to let that chair define you. But it does define me, Clark. You don't know me. Not really. You never saw me before this thing. I loved my life, Clark. Really loved it. I loved my job, my travels, the things I was. I loved being a physical person. I liked riding my motorbike, hurling myself off great heights. I liked crushing people in business deals. I liked having sex, lots of sex. I led a big life. His voice had lifted now. I'm not designed to exist in this thing. And yet, for all intents and purposes, it is now the thing that defines me. It's the only thing that defines me. But you're not even giving it a chance, I whispered. My voice didn't seem to want to emerge from my chest. You're not giving me a chance. It's not a matter of giving you a chance. I've watched you these 6 months becoming a whole different person, someone who's only just beginning to see her possibilities. You have no idea how happy that has made me. I don't want you to be tied to me, to my hospital appointments, to the restrictions on my life. I don't want you to miss out on all the things someone else could give you. And, selfishly, I don't want you to look at me one day and feel even the tiniest bit of regret or pity that... I would never think that. You don't know that, Clark. You have no idea how this would play out. You have no idea how you're going to feel even 6 months from now. And I don't want to look at you every day, to see you naked, to watch you wandering around the annex in your crazy dresses and not be able to do what I want with you. Oh, Clark, if you had any idea what I want to do to you right now. And I can't live with that knowledge. I can't. It's not who I am. I can't be the kind of man who just accepts. He glanced down at his chair, his voice breaking. I will never accept this. I had begun to cry. Please, Will. Please don't say this. Just give me a chance. Give us a chance. Shh. Just listen. You, of all people, listen to what I'm saying. This, tonight, is the most wonderful thing you could have done for me. What you have told me, what you have done in bringing me here, knowing that somehow from that complete arse I was at the start of this, you managed to salvage something to love, is astonishing to me. But I felt his fingers close on mine. I need it to end here. No more chair. No more pneumonia. No more burning limbs. No more pain and tiredness and waking up every morning already wishing it was over. When we get back, I'm still going to go to Switzerland. And if you do love me, Clark, as you say you do, the thing that would make me happier than anything is if you would come with me. My head whipped back. What? It's not going to get any better than this. The odds are I'm only going to get increasingly unwell. and my life, reduced as it is going to get smaller. The doctors have said as much. There are a host of conditions encroaching on me. I can feel it. I don't want to be in pain anymore, or trapped in this thing, or dependent on everyone, or afraid. So I'm asking you, if you feel the things you say you feel, then do it. Be with me. Give me the end I'm hoping for. I looked at him in horror, my blood thumping in my ears. I could barely take it in. How can you ask me that? I know it's... I tell you I love you, and I want to build a future with you. And you ask me to come and watch you kill yourself? I'm sorry. I don't mean it to sound blunt. But I haven't got the luxury of time. What? Why, are you actually booked in? Is there some appointment you're afraid of missing? I could see people at the hotel stopping, perhaps hearing our raised voices, but I didn't care. Yes, Will said after a pause. Yes, there is. I've had the consultations. The clinic agreed that I'm a suitable case for them. And my parents agreed to the 13th of August. We're due to fly out the day before. My head had begun to spin. It was less than a week away. I don't believe this. Louisa, I thought I was changing your mind. He tilted his head sideways and gazed at me. His voice was soft, his eyes gentle. Louisa, nothing was ever going to change my mind. I promised my parents 6 months, and that's what I've given them. You've made that time more precious than you can imagine. You stopped it from being an endurance test. Don't! What? Don't say another word. I was choking. You are so selfish, Will. So stupid. Even if there was the remotest possibility of me coming with you to Switzerland, even if you thought I might, after all I've done for you, be someone who could do that, is that all you can say to me? I tore my heart out in front of you, and all you can say is, no, you're not enough for me, and now I want you to come watch the worst thing you can possibly imagine. The thing I've dreaded ever since I first found out about it. Do you have any idea what you're asking of me? I was raging now, standing in front of him, shouting like a madwoman. Fuck you, Will Traynor! Fuck you! I wish I'd never taken this stupid job! I wish I'd never met you! I burst into tears, ran up the beach and back to my hotel room, away from him. His voice, calling my name, rang in my ears long after I had closed the door. Chapter 24. There is nothing more disconcerting to passers-by than to see a man in a wheelchair pleading with a woman who is meant to be looking after him. It's apparently not really the done thing to be angry with your disabled charge, especially when he's plainly unable to move and is saying gently, Clark, please, just come over here. Please. But I couldn't. I couldn't look at him. Nathan had packed up Will's stuff, and I'd met them both in the lobby the following morning, Nathan still groggy from his hangover. And from the moment we had to be in each other's company again, I refused to have anything to do with Will. I was furious and miserable. There was an insistent, raging voice inside my head that demanded to be as far as possible from him, to go home, to never see him again. You okay? Nathan said, appearing at my shoulder. As soon as we arrived at the airport, I marched away from them to the check-in desk. Nope, I said, and I don't want to talk about it. Hungover? No, There was a short silence.
This mean what I think it does?
He was suddenly somber. I couldn't speak. I nodded, and I watched Nathan's jaw stiffen briefly. He was stronger than I was, though. He was, after all, a professional. Within minutes he was back with Will, showing him something he'd seen in a magazine, wondering aloud about the prospects for some football team they both knew of. Watching them, you would know nothing of the momentousness of the news I'd just imparted. I managed to make myself busy for the entire wait at the airport. I found a thousand small tasks to do, attending to the luggage labels, buying coffee, perusing newspapers, going to the loo, all of which meant that I didn't have to look at him. I didn't have to talk to him. But every now and then Nathan would disappear, and we were left alone, sitting beside each other, the short distance between us jangling with unspoken recriminations. Clark, he would begin. Don't! I would cut him off. I don't want to talk to you. I surprised myself with how cold I could be. I certainly surprised the flight attendants. I saw them on the flight, muttering among themselves at the way I turned rigidly away from Will, plugging my earphones in, or resolutely staring out the window. For once, he didn't get angry. That was almost the worst of it. He didn't get angry, and he didn't get sarcastic, and he simply grew quieter until he barely spoke. It was left to poor Nathan to bounce the conversation along, to ask questions about tea or coffee or spare packets of dry roasted peanuts, or whether anyone minded if he climbed past us to go to the loo. It probably sounds childish now, but it wasn't just a matter of pride. I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear the thought that I would lose him, that he was so stubborn and determined not to see what was good, what could be good, that he wouldn't change his mind. I couldn't believe that he would stick to that one date as if it were cast in stone. A million silent arguments rattled around my head. Why is this not enough for you? Why am I not enough for you? Why couldn't you have confided in me? If we'd had more time, would this have been different? Every now and then I would catch myself staring down at his tanned hands, those squared-off fingers, just inches from my own, and I would remember how our fingers felt entwined, the warmth of him, the illusion, even in stillness, of a kind of strength, and a lump would rise in my throat until I thought I could barely breathe, and I had to retreat to the WC, where I would lean over the sink and sob silently under the strip lighting. There were a few occasions when I thought about what Will still intended to do that I actually had to fight the urge to scream. I felt overcome by a kind of madness and thought I might just sit down in the aisle and howl until someone else stepped in, until someone else made sure he couldn't do it. So although I looked childish, although I seemed to the cabin staff, as I declined to talk to Will, to look at him, to feed him, as if I were the most heartless of women, I knew that pretending he was not there was about the only way I could cope with these hours of enforced proximity. If I had believed Nathan capable of handling everything alone, I would honestly have changed my flight, perhaps even disappeared until I could make sure that there was a whole continent between us, not just a few impossible inches. The two men slept, and it came as something of a relief, a brief respite from the tension. I stared at the television screen, and with every mile that we flew toward home, I felt my heart grow heavier, my anxiety greater. It began to occur to me then that my failure was not just my own. Will's parents were going to be devastated. They'd probably blame me. Will's sister would probably sue me. And it was my failure for Will, too. I had failed to persuade him. I had offered him everything I could, including myself, and nothing I had shown him had convinced him of a reason to keep living. Perhaps, I found myself thinking, he deserves someone better than me. Someone cleverer. Someone like Trina might have thought of better things to do. They might have found some rare piece of medical research or something that could have helped him. They might have changed his mind. The fact that I was going to have to live with this knowledge for the rest of my life made me feel almost dizzy.
Want a drink, Clark?
Will's voice would break into my thoughts. No, thank you.
Is my elbow too far over your armrest?
No, it's fine. It was only in those last few hours, in the dark, that I allowed myself to look at him. My gaze slid slowly sideways from my glowing television screen until I gazed at him surreptitiously in the dim light of the little cabin. And as I took in his face, so tanned and handsome, so peaceful in sleep, a solitary tear rolled down my cheek. Perhaps in some way conscious of my scrutiny, Will stirred, but didn't wake. And unseen by the cabin staff, by Nathan, I pulled his blanket slowly up around his neck, tucking it in carefully, to make sure, in the chill of the cabin air conditioning, that Will wouldn't feel the cold. They were waiting at the arrivals gate. I'd somehow known they would be. I'd felt the faintly sick sensation expanding inside me, even as we wheeled Will through passport control, fast-tracked by some well-meaning official, even as I prayed that we would be forced to wait, stuck in a queue that lasted hours, preferably days. But no, we crossed the vast expanse of linoleum, me pushing the baggage trolley, Nathan pushing Will, and as the glass doors opened, there they were, standing at the barrier, side by side in some rare semblance of unity. I saw Mrs. Traynor's face briefly light up as she saw Will, and I thought, absently, of course, he looks so well. And to my shame, I put on my sunglasses, not to hide my exhaustion, but so that she wouldn't immediately see from my naked expression what it was I was going to have to tell her. "Look at you," she was exclaiming. "Will, you look wonderful, really wonderful." Will's father had stooped, his face wreathed in smiles. He was patting his son's chair, his knee.
"We couldn't believe it when Nathan told us you were down on the beach every day. And swimming. What was the water like then? Lovely and warm? It's been raining cats and dogs here, typical August."
Of course, Nathan would have been texting them or calling them, as if they would have let us go all that time without some kind of contact.
"But it was a pretty amazing place," said Nathan.
He had grown quiet too, but now tried to smile, to seem his normal self. I felt frozen, my hand clutching my passport like I was about to go somewhere else. I had to remind myself to breathe.
"Well, we thought you might like a special dinner," Will's father said. "There's a jolly nice restaurant at the Intercontinental. Champagne on us. What do you think? Your mother and I thought it might be a nice treat."
"Sure," said Will. He was smiling at his mother, and she was looking back at him as if she wanted to bottle it. "How can you?" I wanted to yell at him. "How can you look at her like that when you already know what you're going to do to her?"
"Come on, then. I've got the car in disabled parking. It's only a short ride from here. I was pretty sure you'd all be a bit jet-lagged. Nathan, do you want me to take any of those bags?"
My voice broke into the conversation. "Actually," I said, I was already pulling my luggage from the trolley, "I think I'm going to head off. Thank you anyway." I was focused on my bag, deliberately not looking at them, but even above the hubbub of the airport I could detect the brief silence my words provoked. Mr. Traynor's voice was the first to break it.
Come on, Louisa. Let's have a little celebration. We want to hear all about your adventures. I want to know all about the island. And I promise you don't have to tell us everything.
He almost chuckled.
Yes. Mrs. Trainor's voice had a faint edge to it. Do come, Louisa.
No. I swallowed, tried to raise a bland smile. My sunglasses were a shield.
Thank you. I'd really rather get back.
To where?
Said Will. I realized what he was saying. I didn't really have anywhere to go.
I'll go to my parents' house. It'll be fine.
Come with us,
he said. His voice was gentle.
Don't go, Clark. Please.
I wanted to cry then. But I knew with utter certainty that I couldn't be anywhere near him.
No, thank you. I hope you have a lovely meal. I hoisted my bag over my shoulder, and before anyone could say anything else, I was walking away from them, swallowed up by the crowds in the terminal.
I was almost at the bus stop when I heard her.
Camilla Trainor, her heels clipping on the pavement, half walked, half ran toward me. Stop, Louisa. Please, stop.
I turned, and she was forcing her way through a coach party, casting the backpacking teenagers aside like Moses parting the waves. The airport lights were bright on her hair, turning it a kind of copper colour. She was wearing a fine grey pashmina, which draped artistically over one shoulder. I remember thinking absently how beautiful she must have been only a few years earlier.
Please, please stop.
I stopped, glancing behind me at the road, wishing that the bus would appear now, that it would scoop me up and take me away, that anything would happen. A small earthquake, maybe.
Louisa?
He had a good time. My voice sounded clipped. Oddly like her own, I found myself thinking.
He does look well. Very well.
She stared at me, standing there on the pavement. She was suddenly, acutely still, despite the sea of people moving around her. We didn't speak. And then I said, Mrs. Trainor, I'd like to hand in my notice. I can't do these last few days. I'll forfeit any money owed to me. In fact, I don't want this month's money. I don't want anything.
She went pale then. I saw the colour drain from her face, the way she swayed a little in the morning sunshine. I saw Mr. Trainor coming up behind her, his stride brisk, one hand holding his Panama hat firmly on his head. He was muttering his apologies as he pushed through the crowds, his eyes fixed on me and his wife as we stood rigidly a few feet apart.
You said you thought he was happy. You said you thought this might change his mind.
She sounded desperate, as if she were pleading with me to say something else, to give her some different result. I couldn't speak. I stared at her, and the most I could manage was a small shake of my head. I'm sorry, I whispered, so quietly that she couldn't have heard me. He was almost there as she fell. It was as if her legs just gave way under her, and Mr. Trainor's left arm shot out and caught her as she went down, her mouth a great O, her body slumped against his. His hat fell to the pavement. He glanced up at me, his face confused, not yet registering what had just taken place. And I couldn't look. I turned, numb. And I began to walk, one foot in front of the other, my legs moving almost before I knew what they were doing, away from the airport, not yet even knowing where it was I was going to go.
Chapter 25 Katrina
Louisa didn't come out of her room for a whole 36 hours after she got back from her holiday. She arrived back from the airport late evening on the Sunday, pale as a ghost under her suntan. And we couldn't work that out for a start. She had definitely said she'd see us first thing Monday morning. "I just need to sleep," she had said, then shut herself in her room and gone straight to bed. We had thought it a little odd, but what did we know? Lou has been peculiar since birth, after all. Mum had taken up a mug of tea in the morning, and Lou had not stirred. By supper, Mum had become worried and shaken her, checking she was alive. She can be a bit melodramatic, Mum. Although, to be fair, she had made fish pie, and she probably just wanted to make sure Lou wasn't going to miss it. But Lou wouldn't eat, and she wouldn't talk, and she wouldn't come downstairs. "I just want to stay here for a bit, Mum," she said into her pillow. Finally, Mum left her alone. "She's not herself," said Mum. "Do you think it's some kind of delayed reaction to the thing with Patrick?"
"She couldn't give his stuff about Patrick," Dad said. "I told her he rang to tell us he came in 157th in the Viking thing. She couldn't have looked less interested." He sipped his tea. "Mind you, to be fair to her, even I found it pretty hard to get excited about 157th.
"Do you think she's ill? All that sleeping isn't like her. She might have some terrible tropical disease."
"She's just jet-lagged," I said. I said it with some authority, knowing that Mum and Dad tended to treat me as an expert on all sorts of matters that none of us really knew anything about.
"Jet-lag? Well, if that's what long-haul travel does to you, I think I'll stick with Tembi. What do you think, Josie, love?"
"Oh, I don't know. Who would have thought a holiday could make you look so ill?"
Mum shook her head. I went upstairs after supper. I didn't knock. It was still, strictly speaking, my room after all, and given that I was here for a whole week's break, it should by rights have been me in there. The air was thick and stale, and I pulled the blind up and opened a window so that Lou turned groggily from under the duvet, shielding her eyes from the light, dust motes swirling around her. "You going to tell me what happened?" I put a mug of tea on the bedside table. She blinked at me.
"Mum thinks you've got Ebola virus. She's busy warning all the neighbours who have booked onto the bingo club trip to PortAventura."
She didn't say anything. "Lou?" "I quit," she said quietly.
"Why?"
"Why do you think?" She pushed herself upright and reached clumsily for the mug, taking a long sip of tea. For someone who had just spent almost 2 weeks in Mauritius, she looked bloody awful. Her eyes were tiny and red-rimmed, and her skin, without the tan, would have been even blotchier. Her hair stuck up on one side. She looked like she'd been awake for several years, but most of all she looked sad. I'd never seen my sister look so sad. "You think he's really going to go through with it?" She nodded, then she swallowed hard. "Shit. Oh, Lou, I'm really sorry." I motioned to her to shove over, and I climbed into bed beside her. She took another sip of her tea, and then leant her head on my shoulder. She was wearing my T-shirt. I didn't say anything about it. That was how bad I felt for her.
"What do I do, Treen?" Her voice was small, like Thomas's, when he hurts himself and is trying to be really brave.
Outside we could hear the neighbour's dog running up and down alongside the garden fence, chasing the neighbourhood cats. Every now and then we could hear a burst of manic barking. The dog's head would be popping up over the top right now, its eyes bulging with frustration.
"I'm not sure there's anything you can do." "Oh, God, all that stuff you fixed up for him, all that effort." "I told him I loved him," she said, her voice dropping to a whisper. "And he just said it wasn't enough." Her eyes were wide and bleak. "How am I supposed to live with that?"
"I am the one in the family who knows everything. I read more than anyone else. I go to the university. I am the one who is supposed to have all the answers."
But I looked at my big sister, and I shook my head. "I haven't got a clue," I said. She finally emerged the following day, showered and wearing clean clothes, and I told Mum and Dad not to say a word. I implied it was boyfriend trouble, and Dad raised his eyebrows and made a face as if that explained everything, and God only knew what we had been working ourselves into such a fuss over. Mum ran off to ring the bingo club and tell them she'd had second thoughts about the risks of air travel. Lou ate a piece of toast. She didn't want lunch. And she put on a big floppy sun hat, and we walked up to the castle with Thomas to feed the ducks. I don't think she really wanted to go out, but Mum insisted that we all needed some fresh air. This, in my mother's vocabulary, meant she was itching to get into the bedroom and air it and change the bedding. Thomas skipped and hopped ahead of us, clutching a plastic bag full of crusts. And we negotiated the meandering tourists with an ease born of years of practice, ducking out of the way of swinging backpacks, separating around posing couples and rejoining on the other side. The castle baked in the high heat of summer, the ground cracked and the grass wispy, like the last hairs on the head of a balding man. The flowers in the tubs looked defeated, as if they were already half preparing for autumn. Lou and I didn't say much. What was there to say? As we walked past the tourist car park, I saw her glance under her brim at the trainer's house. It stood elegant and red brick, its tall, blank windows disguising whatever life-changing drama was being played out in there, perhaps even at this moment. "You could go and talk to him, you know," I said. "I'll wait here for you." She looked at the ground, folded her arms across her chest, and we kept walking. "There's no point," she said. I knew the other bit, the bit she didn't say aloud. "He's probably not even there." We did a slow circuit of the castle, watching Thomas roll down the steep parts of the hill, feeding the ducks that by this stage in the season were so well stuffed they could barely be bothered to come over for mere bread. I watched my sister as we walked, seeing her brown back exposed by her halter neck top, her stooped shoulders, and I realized that even if she didn't know it yet, everything had changed for her. She wouldn't stay here now, no matter what happened with Will Trainer. She had an air about her, a new air of knowledge, of things seen, places she had been. My sister finally had new horizons. "Oh," I said as we headed back towards the gates, "you got a letter from the college while you were away. Sorry, I opened it. I thought it must be for me." "You opened it?" I had been hoping it was extra grant money. "You got an interview?" She blinked as if receiving news from some long distant past. "Yeah, and the big news is it's tomorrow," I said. "So I thought maybe we should go over some possible questions tonight." She shook her head. "I can't go to an interview tomorrow." "What else are you going to do?" "I can't, Treen," she said sorrowfully. "How am I supposed to think about anything at a time like this?" "Listen, Lou, they don't give interviews out like bread for ducks, you idiot. This is a big deal. They know you're a mature student, you're applying at the wrong time of year, and they're still going to see you. You can't muck them around." "I don't care. I can't think about it." "But you..." "Just leave me alone, Treen, okay? I can't do it." "Hey," I said. I stepped in front of her so that she couldn't keep walking. Thomas was talking to a pigeon a few paces up ahead. "This is exactly the time you have to think about it. This is the time when, like it or not, you finally have to work out what you're going to do with the rest of your life." We were blocking the path. Now the tourists had to separate to walk around us. They did so, heads down, or eyeing with mild curiosity the arguing sisters. "I can't..." "Well, tough, because in case you forgot, you have no job anymore. No Patrick to pick up the pieces. And if you miss this interview, then in 2 days' time you are headed back down the job centre to decide whether you want to be a chicken processor or a lap dancer or wipe some other person's bum for a living. And believe it or not, because you are now headed for 30, that's your life pretty well mapped out. And all of this, everything you've learnt over the past 6 months, will have been a waste of time, all of it." She stared at me, wearing that look of mute fury she wears when she knows I am right and she can't say anything back. Thomas appeared beside us now and pulled at my hand.
"Mum, you said bum."
My sister was still glaring at me, but I could see her thinking.
I turned to my son. No, sweetheart, I said bun. We're going to go home for tea now, aren't we, Lou? And see if we can have some buns. And then, while Granny gives you a bath, I'm going to help Auntie Lou do her homework. Mum looked after Thomas the next day, so I saw Lou off on the bus. I didn't hold out a lot of hope for the interview, so I spent the day at the library, worrying about my own future instead of hers. Over dinner that night, I glanced over at Lou. She was gazing at her plate, pushing the roast chicken around as if trying to disguise it. Uh-oh, I thought.
You not hungry, love?
Said Mum, following the line of my gaze. Not very, she said.
It is very warm for chicken, Mum conceded. I just thought you needed perking up a bit.
So, you going to tell us how you got on at this interview? Dad's fork stopped halfway to his mouth.
Oh, that.
She looked distracted, as if he had just regged up something she did 5 years ago. Yes, that. She speared a tiny piece of chicken.
It was okay.
Dad glanced at me. I gave a tiny shrug. Just okay? They must have given you some idea how you did.
I got it.
What? She was still looking down at her plate. I stopped chewing. They said I was exactly the kind of applicant they were looking for. I've got to do some kind of foundation course, which takes a year, and then I can convert it. Dad sat back in his chair.
Well, that's fantastic news!
Mum reached over and patted her shoulder. Oh, well done, love, that's brilliant! Not really. I don't think I can afford 4 years of study.
Oh, don't you worry about that just now, really. Look how well Trina's managing.
Hey, he nudged her.
We'll find a way. We always find a way, don't we?
Dad beamed at us both. I think everything's turning around for us now, girls. I think this is going to be a good time for this family. And then, out of nowhere, she burst into tears. Real tears. She cried like Thomas cries, wailing, all snot and tears and not caring who hears, her sobs breaking through the silence of the little room like a knife. Thomas stared at her, open-mouthed, so that I had to haul him onto my lap and distract him so that he didn't get upset too. And while I fiddled with bits of potato and talking peas and made silly voices, she told them. She told them everything, about Will and the 6-month contract, and what had happened when they went to Mauritius. As she spoke, Mum's hands went to her mouth. Grandad looked solemn. The chicken grew cold, the gravy congealing in its boat. Dad shook his head in disbelief. And then, as my sister detailed her flight home from the Indian Ocean, her voice dropping to a whisper as she spoke of her last words to Mrs. Traynor, he pushed his chair back and stood up. He walked slowly around the table, and he took her in his arms, like he had when we were little. He stood there and held her really, really tightly to him.
Oh, Jesus Christ, the poor fella. And poor you, oh, Jesus.
I'm not sure I ever saw Dad look so shocked. What a bloody mess.
You went through all this without saying anything, and all we got was a postcard about scuba diving.
My mother was incredulous.
But we thought you were having the holiday of a lifetime.
I wasn't alone. Trina knew, she said, looking at me. Trina was great. I didn't do anything, I said, hugging Thomas. He had lost interest in the conversation now that Mum had put an open tin of celebrations in front of him. I was just an ear. You did the lot. You came up with all the ideas. Some ideas they turned out to be. She leant against Dad, sounding bereft. Dad tilted her chin so that she had to look at him. But you did everything you could.
And I failed.
Who says you failed? Dad stroked her hair back from her face. His face was tender. I'm just thinking of what I know about Will Traynor, what I know about men like him, and I'll say one thing to you. I'm not sure anyone in the world was ever going to persuade that man once he'd set his mind to something. He's who he is. You can't make people change who they are.
But his parents, they can't let him kill himself, said Mum. What kind of people are they?
They're normal people, Mum. Mrs. Traynor just doesn't know what else she can do.
Well, not bloody taking him to this clinic would be a start.
Mum was angry. 2 points of colour had risen to her cheekbones.
I would fight for you two, for Thomas, until my dying breath.
Even if he'd already tried to kill himself, I said, in really grim ways.
He's ill, Katrina. He's depressed. People who are vulnerable should not be given the chance to do something that they'll...
She trailed off in mute fury and dabbed at her eyes with a napkin.
That woman must be heartless, heartless. And to think they got Louisa involved in all this. She's a magistrate, for goodness sake. You'd think a magistrate would know what was right or wrong. Of all people, I've a good mind to head down there now and bring him back here.
It's complicated, Mum.
No, it's not. He's vulnerable, and there is no way on earth she should entertain the thought of it. I'm shocked, that poor man...
She got up from the table, taking the remains of the chicken with her, and stalked out to the kitchen. Louisa watched her go, her expression a little stunned. Mum was never angry. I think the last time we heard her raise a voice was 1993. Dad shook his head, his mind apparently elsewhere.
I've just thought, no wonder I hadn't seen Mr. Traynor. I wondered where he was. I assumed they were all off on some family holiday.
They've gone. Well, he's not been in these last 2 days. Lou sat back down and slumped in her chair. Oh, shit, I said, and then clamped my hands around Thomas's ears.
It's tomorrow.
Lou looked at me and I glanced up at the calendar on the wall.
The 13th of August, it's tomorrow.
Lou did nothing that last day. She was up before me, staring out of the kitchen window. It rained and then it cleared, and then it rained again. She lay on the sofa with Grandad, and she drank the tea that Mum made her, and every half an hour or so I watched her gaze slide silently towards the mantelpiece and check the clock. It was awful to watch. I took Thomas swimming and I tried to make her come with us. I said Mum would mind him if she wanted to go to the shops with me later. I said I'd take her to the pub, just the two of us, but she refused every offer. What if I made a mistake, Katrine? She said, so quietly that only I could hear it. I glanced up at Grandad, but he had eyes only for the racing. I think Dad was still putting on a sneaky bet each way for him, even though he denied it to Mum.
What do you mean?
What if I should have gone with him?
You said you couldn't.
Outside, the skies were grey. She stared through our immaculate windows at the miserable day beyond.
I know what I said, but I just can't bear not knowing what's happening.
Her face crumpled a little.
I can't bear not knowing how he's feeling. I can't bear the fact that I never even got to say goodbye.
Couldn't you go now? Maybe try and get a flight?
It's too late, she said,
and then she closed her eyes.
I never get there in time. There's only 2 hours left until it stops for the day. I looked it up on the internet.
I waited.
They don't do it after 5:30.
She shook her head in amusement.
Something to do with the Swiss officials who have to be there. They don't like certifying things outside office hours.
I almost laughed, but I didn't know what to say to her. I couldn't imagine having to wait as she was waiting, knowing what might be happening in some far-off place. I had never loved a man like she seemed to love Will. I had liked men, sure, and wanted to sleep with them, but sometimes I wondered if I was missing some sensitivity chip. I couldn't imagine crying over anyone I'd been with. The only equivalent was if I thought about Thomas, waiting to die in some strange country,
And as soon as that thought came to mind, it made something inside me actually flip over. It was so hideous. So I stuck that in the back of my mental filing cabinet too, under the drawer labelled Unthinkable. I sat down beside my sister on the sofa, and we stared in silence at the 3:30 maiden stakes, then the 4 o'clock handicap stakes, and the four races that followed it, with the fixed intensity of people who might actually have all the money in the world on the winner. And then the doorbell rang. Louisa was off the sofa and in the hallway in seconds. She opened the door, and the way she wrenched it open made even my heart stop. But it wasn't Will there on the doorstep. It was a young woman, her makeup thick and perfectly applied, her hair cut in a neat bob around her chin. She folded her umbrella and smiled, reaching round towards the large bag she had over her shoulder. I wondered briefly if this was Will Traynor's sister.
"Louisa Clark?"
"Yes. I'm from the Globe. I wondered if I could have a quick word."
The Globe?"
I could hear the confusion in Lou's voice.
"The newspaper."
I stepped behind my sister. I saw then the notepad in the woman's hand.
"Can I come in? I'd just like to have a little chat with you about William Traynor. You do work for William Traynor, don't you?"
"No comment," I said, and before the woman had a chance to say anything else, I slammed the door in her face. My sister stood stunned in the hallway. She flinched as the doorbell rang again.
"Don't answer it," I hissed.
"But how..." I began to push her up the stairs. God, she was impossibly slow. It was like she was half asleep.
"Grandad, don't answer the door," I yelled.
"Who have you told?" I said when we reached the landing.
"Someone must have told them. Who knows?"
"Miss Clark,"
the woman's voice came through the letterbox,
"if you just give me 10 minutes, we do understand this is a very sensitive issue. We'd like you to put your side of the story."
Does this mean he's dead? Her eyes had filled with tears.
"No, it just means some arse is trying to cash in," I thought for a minute.
"Who was that, girls?"
Mum's voice came up the stairwell.
"No one, Mum. Just don't answer the door."
I peered over the banister. Mum was holding a tea towel in her hands and gazing at the shadowy figure visible through the glass panels of the front door.
"Don't answer the door?"
I took my sister's elbow. "Lou, you didn't say anything to Patrick, did you?" She didn't need to say anything. Her stricken face said it all.
"Okay, don't have a baby. Just don't go near the door. Don't answer the phone. Don't say a word to them, okay?"
Mum was not amused. She was even less amused after the phone started ringing. After the fifth call, we put all calls through to the answering machine, but we still had to listen to them, their voices invading our little hallway. There were 4 or 5 of them, all the same, all offering Lou the chance to put her side of the story, as they called it. Like Will Traynor was now some commodity that they were all scrabbling over. The telephone rang, and the doorbell rang. We sat with the curtains closed, listening to the reporters on the pavement just outside our gate, chatting to each other and speaking on their mobile phones. It was like being under siege. Mum wrung her hands and shouted through the letterbox for them to get the hell out of our front garden whenever one of them ventured past the gate. Thomas gazed out of the upstairs bathroom window and wanted to know why there were people in our garden. 4 of our neighbours rang, wanting to know what was going on. Dad parked in Ivy Street and came home via the back garden, and we had a fairly serious talk about castles and boiling oil. Then, after I'd thought a bit longer, I rang Patrick and asked him how much he had got for his sordid little tip. The slight delay before he denied everything told me all I needed to know.
"You shitbag," I yelled. "I'm going to kick your stupid marathon-running shin so hard you're going to think 157th was actually a good result."
Lou just sat in the kitchen and cried. Not proper sobbing. Just silent tears that ran down her face, and which she wiped away with the palm of her hand. I couldn't think what to say to her. Which was fine. I had plenty to say to everyone else.
All but one of the reporters cleared off by 7:30. I didn't know if they had given up, or if Thomas's habit of posting bits of Lego out of the letterbox every time they passed another note through had become boring. I told Louisa to bath Thomas for me, mainly because I wanted her to get out of the kitchen, but also because that way I could go through all the messages on our answer phone and delete the newspaper ones while she couldn't hear me. 26. 26 of the buggers, and all sounding so nice, so understanding. Some of them even offered her money. I pressed delete on everyone, even those offering money, although I admit I was a teeny bit tempted to see how much they were offering. All the while I heard Lou talking to Thomas in the bathroom, alongside the whine and splash of him dive-bombing his 6 inches of soap suds with the Batmobile. That's the thing you don't know about children unless you have them. Bath time, Lego, and fish fingers don't allow you to dwell on tragedy for too long. And then I hit the last message. Louisa, it's Camilla Trainup. Will you call me as soon as possible? I stared at the answer phone. I rewound and replayed it. Then I ran upstairs and whipped Thomas out of the bath so fast my boy didn't even know what hit him. He was standing there, the towel wrapped tightly around him like a compression bandage, and Lou, stumbling and confused, was already halfway down the stairs, me pushing her by the shoulder. But what if she hates me? She didn't sound like she hated you. But what if the press are surrounding them there? What if they think it's all my fault? Her eyes were wide and terrified. What if she's ringing to tell me he's done it? Oh, for Christ's sake, Lou, for once in your life, just get a grip. You won't know anything unless you call. Call her, just call. You don't have a bloody choice. I ran back into the bathroom to set Thomas free. I shoved him into his pyjamas, told him that Granny had a biscuit for him if he ran to the kitchen super fast. And then I peered out of the bathroom door to peek at my sister on the phone down in the hallway. She was turned away from me, one hand smoothing the hair at the back of her head. She reached out a hand to steady herself. Yes, she was saying, I see. And then, okay. And after a pause, yes. She looked down at her feet for a good minute after she put the phone down. Well, I said. She looked up as if she'd only just seen me there, and shook her head. It was nothing about the newspapers, she said, her voice still numb with shock.
He's still alive. Lou smiled shakily. She asked me, begged me, to come to Switzerland. And she's booked me onto the last flight out this evening.
Chapter 26. In other circumstances, I suppose it might have seemed strange that I, Lou Clark, a girl who'd rarely been more than a bus ride from her hometown in 20 years, was now flying to her third country in less than a week. But I packed an overnight case with the swift efficiency of a flight attendant, rejecting all but the barest necessities. Trina ran around silently fetching any other things she thought I might need, and then we headed downstairs. We stopped halfway down. Mum and Dad were already in the hall, standing side by side in the ominous way they used to do when we sneaked back late from a night out. "What's going on?" Mum was staring at my case. Trina had stopped in front of me. "Lou's going to Switzerland," she said, "and she needs to leave now. There's only one flight left today." We were about to move when Mum stepped forward. "No." Her mouth was set into an unfamiliar line, her arms folded awkwardly in front of her. "Really, I don't want you involved. If this is what I think it is, then no." "But," Trina began, glancing behind at me. "No," said Mum, and her voice held an unusually steely quality. "No buts. I've been thinking about this, about everything you told us. It's wrong, morally wrong, And if you get embroiled in it, and you're seen to be helping a man kill himself, then you could end up in all sorts of trouble.
Your mum's right,
Dad said. We've seen it in the news. This could affect your whole life, Lou. This college interview, everything. If you get a criminal record, you'll never get a college degree or a good job or anything. He's asked for her to come. She can't just ignore him, Trina interrupted. Yes, yes she can. She's given 6 months of her life to this family, and a fat lot of good it's brought her, judging by the state of things. A fat lot of good it's brought this family, with people banging on the door, and all the neighbours thinking we've been done for benefit fraud or some such. No, she's finally got the chance to make something of herself, and now they want her to go to that dreadful place in Switzerland and get involved in God knows what. Well, I say no. No, Louisa. But she has to go, Trina said. No, she doesn't. She's done enough. She said herself last night she's done everything she could. Mum shook her head. Whatever mess the trainers are going to make of their lives going to this... whatever they're going to do to their own son, I don't want Louisa involved. I don't want her ruining her whole life. I think I can make up my own mind, I said. I'm not sure you can. This is your friend, Louisa. This is a young man with his whole life ahead of him. You cannot be part of this. I'm shocked that you could even consider it. Mum's voice had a new, hard edge. I didn't bring you up to help someone end his life. Would you end Granddad's life? Do you think we should shove him off to Dignitas, too? Granddad is different. No, he isn't. He can't do what he used to. But his life is precious, just as Will's is precious. It's not my decision, Mum. It's Will's. The whole point of this is to support Will. Support Will? I've never heard such rubbish. You're a child, Louisa. You've seen nothing, done nothing, and you have no idea what this is going to do to you. How in God's name will you ever be able to sleep at night if you help him to go through with it? You'd be helping a man to die. Do you really understand that? You'd be helping Will, that lovely, clever young man, to die. I'd sleep at night, because I trust Will to know what's right for him, and because what's been the worst thing for him has been losing the ability to make a single decision, to do a single thing for himself. I looked at my parents, trying to make them understand. I'm not a child. I love him. I love him, and I shouldn't have left him alone, and I can't bear not being there and not knowing what he's... I swallowed. So, yes, I'm going. I don't need you to look out for me, or understand. I'll deal with it. But I'm going to Switzerland, whatever either of you says. The little hallway grew silent. Mum stared at me like she had no idea who I was. I took a step closer to her, trying to make her understand, but as I did, she took a step back. Mum? I owe Will. I owe it to him to go. Who do you think got me to apply to college? Who do you think encouraged me to make something of myself, to travel places, to have ambitions? Who changed the way I think about everything? About myself, even? Will did. I've done more, lived more, in the last 6 months than in the last 27 years of my life. So if he wants me to go to Switzerland, then yes, I'm going to go, whatever the outcome. We all stood staring at one another. Dad and Trina were shooting glances at each other, as if each of them was waiting for the other to say something. But Mum broke the silence. If you go, Louisa, you needn't come back. The words fell out of her mouth like pebbles. I looked at my mother in shock. Her gaze was unyielding. It tensed.